Chapter 5, The Fall of Jericho. We have already referred to the warlike character of Pharaoh Thutmosis III and his expeditions into Canaan and Syria. These he conducted in person and with great success, bringing back with him huge spoils and levying an annual tribute upon the peoples he conquered, deposing their rulers and setting up chiefs who were responsible to himself. In the records of his campaigns, he claims to have taken over 100 cities, several of which were in the land of Canaan and lay along the main route from Egypt to the Euphrates. This policy of invasion continued during the succeeding reigns of Amenhotep II, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and Thutmosis IV, and must have greatly reduced and enfeebled the inhabitants of Canaan before the Israelites advanced into their territory at Jericho. We now come to the time when, after wandering 40 years in the wilderness, the children of Israel, under the leadership of Joshua, cross the river Jordan and enter into the borders of the land of promise. This seems to coincide with the early years of the reign of the next pharaoh, namely Amenhotep III, during which the prosperity of Egypt perhaps rose to its highest as a result of the enlargement of the empire by the preceding pharaohs and the vast accumulations of wealth extorted from the peoples over which they were victorious. With this prosperity at home, however, and the peaceful policy of the king, his attention being taken up largely with building the great temple of Luxor and lion hunting expeditions, there commenced a neglect of affairs abroad in the conquered territories, as a result of which the prestige of Egypt in Palestine and Syria began to decline. This increased still more in the succeeding reign of Amenhotep IV, whose main concern consisted in an attempt to change the national religion from the worship of the god Amen to that of another god, Aten, represented by the sun's disk. The king's name was even changed into Akhenaten, embracing the name of the new god, and he was forced by the priests of Amen to leave the old capital of Thebes and set up a new one at Amarna. This inward dissension, together with the religious preoccupation of the pharaoh, only served to increase the neglect of foreign affairs, which had already set in. How suitable, then, were the times to the invasion of Palestine by the Israelites? Here were the Canaanites, the old inhabitants of the land, greatly reduced and impoverished by the Egyptian conquests and tributary, at least nominally, to that great nation. And yet, the Egyptian rule in Palestine was becoming very lax, and their authority decayed, so that a good deal of disorder prevailed, and the Hittite and other peoples were more or less free to devastate the land still further. May we not see in these things the workings of the God of Israel in preparing a way for his ancient people? We must not, however, suppose that the task before the Israelites in possessing the land was at all an easy one. The depredations of the Egyptians were chiefly along the main route from Egypt to the Euphrates, a fact which is borne out by the names of the cities recorded by Thutmosis III as having been captured by him, and the cities which were subjugated were not destroyed, but their rulers replaced by others in allegiance with Egypt, and their peoples placed under tribute. When, 40 years previous, Moses had sent spies into the land, they returned with the report that the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled. Numbers 13, verse 28. Or, as it is in Deuteronomy 1, verse 28, the cities are great and walled up to heaven. Concerning this report, Professor Garstang, in charge of the archaeological expedition sent to Palestine by Sir Charles Marston, says, "Wherever excavation has been attempted in that zone, the results tend to confirm the spy's report." Joshua, Judges, page 123. "Wherever the sites of these ancient cities of Canaan have been excavated, the remains of the huge walls erected for their protection and defense have been discovered." Thus, Jericho was surrounded by double walls, the outer 6 feet thick and the inner 12 feet thick. The latter was found preserved in parts to a height of 18 feet, and both probably rose to a height of 25 to 30 feet. The distance between the two walls was from 4 to 5 yards. At the city of Ai, remains of the enclosing wall have been found still standing to a height of 8 to 10 feet. Again, at Tel El Naspi, which Garstang identifies as the ruins of Gibeon, the massive walls were 17 feet in thickness and are still preserved to a height of 28 feet, page 165. Bethel also was surrounded by a great stone wall, which, on excavation, was found still standing to a height of 13 feet. And so at Jerusalem, as it was the ancient city of the Jebusites, Lachish and other places, remains of the defensive walls which existed at the time of the Israelitish invasion have been unearthed. When Joshua sent his 2 spies to Jericho, they came into Rahab's house and lodged there, and she, preserving them from being captured, let them down by a cord through a window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. Joshua 2, verse 15. This fact of the building of houses upon the city walls has also been verified by the excavations made at Jericho. Speaking of the outer wall, Professor Garstang says, "It seems to have been designed as an additional security, possibly somewhat later than that within, though both had been in common use at the time of the spy's visit more than a century. In the meantime, the pressure upon the limited building space within the original enclosure seems to have been so great that houses had arisen upon the walls themselves, the intervening space being bridged with timber, traces of which are clear among the excavated remains. On the north side, a firmer foundation for such houses was provided by a number of narrow transverse walls of brick, which bonded the outer and inner rampart walls together, page 132. Now we have the armies of Israel before Jericho. This first of the walled cities which they were to assail, and the divine method for their doing so was that they should compass the city once daily for 6 days, and on the seventh day 7 times, after which the people were to shout with a great shout. Thereupon the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they burnt the city with fire, and all that was therein, Joshua 6, verses 20 to 25. This is the biblical record, and here again, the excavations made among the ruins clearly corroborate the truth of the scriptures. To quote again from Garstang's book, he says, "Investigations along the west side show continuous signs of destruction and conflagration. The outer wall suffered most, its remains falling down the slope. The inner wall is preserved only where it abuts upon the citadel or tower to a height of 18 feet. Elsewhere, it is found largely to have fallen, together with the remains of buildings upon it, into the space between the walls, which was filled with ruins and debris. Traces of intense fire are plain to see, including reddened masses of bricks, cracked stones, charred timbers, and ashes. Houses alongside the wall are found burned to the ground, their roofs fallen upon the domestic pottery within. As to the main fact, then, there remains no doubt the walls fell outwards so completely that the attackers would be able to clamber up and over their ruins into the city," pages 145 and 146. More recent reports of excavations made in other parts of the city still further prove the truth of the biblical narrative. Evidence has now come to light, which points to the conclusion that the burning of Jericho at the time of Joshua's invasion was general. There are also indications that the conflagration was accompanied by deliberate, organized destruction. Last year, below the face of the citadel, the northwest tower, a number of rooms of small houses were located, and the contents of some of them were examined, primarily in order to ascertain their date and their relation to the city wall. In one of them were found datable objects, 1600 to 1400 BC, which brought it within sight of the period of the Israelite invasion. In addition, it was found to contain a mass of burnt grain flowing from a broken store pot in the corner, and above all, a number of carbonized beams and burnt matting, which had formed the roof of the house. Evidently, the dwelling had been burnt when still in occupation. The Daily Telegraph, March 10, 1931. Now, after the destruction of the city, we read that Joshua uttered a prophetical curse upon it thus, "Cursed be the man before the Lord that riseth up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it." Joshua 6, verse 26. This is fulfilled some 500 years later in the days of Ahab, as recorded in 1 Kings 16, verse 34. This fact also has been verified by Professor Garstang. Excavations at Jericho have disclosed four chief periods in the occupation of the city. Three of these we have examined. They cover approximately three separate but fairly continuous periods of 200 years each, from 2000 to 1400 BC. But after that date, the city lay in ruins with no appreciable population for some 500 years. The first part of the early Iron Age, 1200 to 900 BC, is not represented at all in the archaeology of the site. The stratifications representing the second phase of the Iron Age, 900 BC, are found in general directly over the destruction layers of the Late Bronze Age. The city was not rebuilt, nor its fortifications restored, until the 9th century BC. The next object of attack by the Israelites was the city of Ai, which was also finally destroyed and burnt. And here again, excavations testify to the truth of the Bible record. And so with Hazor, Joshua 11, verse 11, Kirjath-Sefer, Joshua 15, verse 17, and Bethel, remains of the old city walls and evidences of the destruction that took place about this period have been discovered.